Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints. On this week's show, we remember the work and contributions of Montreal Standard Times journalist and Canadian author Marvis Gallant.
Many people think, and I agree, that she's one of the finest short story writers in the 20th century in English. For this book, we wanted to show the relationship between her journalism and her stories, which is intimate and interesting in all kinds of ways.
Therapists can come in all shapes or forms. A four-legged horse at Minden's Walkabout Farm changes lives in the community.
Each and every time we have somebody here, there's always something profound that happens. And that is pretty incredible to surround yourself with every single day. You can imagine we all leave here at the end of the day are hurt a little bit bigger.
16 zero-emission buses have been purchased as part of Winnipeg's transition fleet project.
The power needed for these buses is huge, so we're working with Manitoba Hydro to scale up all of our infrastructure.
Last October's atmospheric river poured onto BC but had a positive effect. Record salmon counts are observed in West Vancouver. We'll learn why. And it's Canadian Agriculture Literacy Month. We'll go to Fergus, Ontario, where students get to learn more about farming. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Hassan, and I'll be with you for the next half hour with our journalists posted in BC, Alberta, Quebec, and Ontario this week. First, we'll hit the bookshelves. Montreal Standard Time, the early journalism of Marvis Gallant, takes readers back 75 years when the award-winning author was still cutting her teeth as a Montreal journalist. The late Marvis Gallant, who was born in 1922, who died in 2014, spent 6 years working at the now defunct Montreal Standard before moving to Paris and becoming a prolific writer of short stories. Neil Besner, one of the editors behind the new collection, says that Gallant's journalism offers a unique and uniquely local path into her later writing. Jules Bugiel caught up with him and Concordia literature professor Catherine McLeod at the book's launch.
It's been 75 years since Mavis Gallant wrote for the Montreal Standard, but you wouldn't know it from the crowd at Paragraph Bookstore on Wednesday night. They gathered for the launch of Montreal Standard Time, Mavis Gallant's early journalism, a collection of the late author's work from her first career right here in the city.
She began working at a very young age at the Montreal Standard, which was a newspaper in Montreal, and she wrote maybe 125 articles for them, of which we extracted 38.
This is Neil Besner, one of the three editors behind the new collection, chronicling Gallant's journalism career, which spanned 1944 to 1950. A Gallant scholar, Besner hopes the book gives readers new insights into the renowned author, who died just over a decade ago in 2014.
Many people think, and I agree, that she's one of the finest short story writers in the 20th century in English. For this book, we wanted to show the relationship between her journalism and her stories, which is intimate and interesting in all kinds of ways.
Fans of Gallant got a taste of this connection back in 2021, when Frances McDormand played a journalist inspired by Gallant in Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch. That film was set in Paris, where the author lived after leaving her husband, her journalism job, and her hometown of Montreal.
Her whole story is fascinating with like the move to Paris and yet remaining a Canadian writer and really specifically a Montreal writer.
For some in the audience on Wednesday night, Gallant's journalism was a matter of professional as well as personal interest.
My name's Catherine McLeod, and I am a fan of Mavis Gallant's, but I also teach her work at Concordia University.
McLeod says that Gallant isn't always recognized in the canon of Canadian literature. That's something McLeod would like to see change.
Mavis Gallant is such a prolific, celebrated writer who, strangely, sometimes people don't know. And, kind of like when you ask some, often I'll ask a class, like at the start of a CanLit class, you know, who are the Canadian writers that you think of? And usually always like Margaret Atwood is like the first one mentioned. And then there's a variety of other names, but usually not Mavis Gallant. And so I think that, you know, she should be one of those names that comes to mind first.
That's why she started teaching Gallant's journalism as well as her fiction, as a way to root the author in the city her students call home.
In some ways, like it's like the city and her experience growing up, especially as someone who moved back and forth between English and French schools, she carried that all with her. And you really get this like picture of her as a Montrealer before she then goes to Paris. And I think that's sometimes hard to like emphasize to students when it's like she has actually gone to Paris. She lived the rest of her life there. And to really explain that she always remained a Montrealer. And I thought it was nice that that was echoed tonight.
Montreal Standard Time, Mavis Gallant's early journalism, is available now from Véhicule Presse. I'm Jules Bijal with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And we'll now take a breather and a bit of fresh air at the Walkabout Farm in Haliburton, Ontario, where it's less about what you can't do and everything about what you can try to do. With that in mind, Jennifer Seamack, a founder of the Walkabout Farm, thought she would offer therapeutic riding lessons. In this story, journalist Elizabeth Oakley had the opportunity to meet with some of the farm's many four-legged therapists, the horses themselves, that are there to help those with physical and developmental challenges learn that there are no limits to what they can achieve. Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario.
Gracie, sweetheart, patience.
Standing 15 hands tall and weighing 1,200 pounds, you might not think of Gracie as a therapist, but that's exactly the role she plays. As she kicks her hoof against the steel gate of her enclosure, Gracie is asking for attention and treats, seemingly unaware of the important role she plays in improving the lives of others. Here at Walkabout Farm in Minden, she's one of several horses who offer a unique and transformative kind of therapy for children, youth, and even adults. As temperatures begin to rise and the snow starts to melt, Jennifer Seamack, Walkabout Farm's founding executive director and program facilitator, is preparing for another season of therapeutic riding programs here. She says the impact the horses have on clients is nothing short of miraculous.
Each and every time we have somebody here, there's always something profound that happens. And that is pretty incredible to surround yourself with every single day. You can imagine we all leave here at the end of the day, our hurt a little bit bigger, a little bit fuller because of the experiences that these horses have shown us that they are capable of having with other people. It's incredible.
Walkabout Farm began its therapeutic riding programs 8 years ago to provide enrichment for those who are differently abled. Jennifer and her husband were inspired to start the organization after having a child with special needs, knowing there were few local resources. Jennifer is proud to have used her horse sense to create such critically important programs that are free of charge.
I had a very strong background in horses and knew exactly the effect that horses had on my mental health as a child and teenager growing up into adulthood. And that culminated in this idea that I can use my skills and talents and knowledge around horses, combine that with youth mental health and people with physical and developmental disabilities, and create this whole program completely customized for our community here in the Haliburton Highlands. As we've evolved, we've certainly adjusted the scope of practice, for example, involving the entire family. We're not just here to help the one person who the family thinks needs us the most. We end up supporting the entire family unit. And that is something I didn't expect. I didn't expect that youth mental health and working with people with developmental disabilities from the community would actually overshadow the therapeutic riding program itself. Initially, I thought that would be the biggest draw because it has such tremendous benefits for physical therapy for people to have a session on horseback. horse's movement mimics the human's movement. And so the horse is able to move the body in exactly the way that was intended to. So if you have a child or a young person with cerebral palsy, for example, they've never been able to move their body in the quote unquote correct, you know, skeletal way that nature intended, but the horse can move them in that way so that they're strengthening certain parts of their body that can't be replicated properly with a physiotherapist or with a machine, but the horse can replicate those things. So that participant's working on their core strength and their little neurons are firing because parts of their body that have been dormant are now being kicked on.
A not-for-profit walkabout farm relies on donations from businesses, organizations, and the public. In the fall, they sell pumpkins from their own patch with fertilizer provided by the horses themselves. Besides the riding programs, Walkabout Farm regularly brings their miniature horses to local long-term care homes and other events for human-horse engagement. They also offer Friendship Fridays at the farm, where everyone is welcome to drop in and visit the horses, bunnies, and cats. Jennifer is grateful to her volunteers who do everything from feeding horses and shoveling manure to offering a listening ear to family members. Volunteers like Tim O'Sullivan, a retired nurse who joined the ranks last fall and who says he loves to be a part of the magic at Walkabout Farm.
Satisfaction knowing that you make a bit of a difference is always cool. And just the joy in seeing these people interacting is just knowing that if it wasn't for people like Jen and others like that, they could be just, you know, sort of sitting at home and watching TV and not doing anything at all. But they're out and they're having fun and they're interacting and it's great.
It's easy to see the love Jennifer has for her four-legged friends, those horses she's picked especially for their gentleness and patience. The horses seem just as drawn to her as she is to them. But it also doesn't hurt that she keeps treats in her pockets, too.
This is Monty. Monty's our newest therapy horse. He's a very rare breed of horse. He's called a Suffolk Punch. So he's a 20-year-old draft horse. A Suffolk Punch has been bred to be short in stature, but as big as a normal draft horse in a smaller frame. So he's less intimidating for our participants to be sitting on than a typical draft, which can be as tall as 18, 19 hands high, which is enormous. So we got him specifically because of his shorter stature, but his ability to carry our heavier participants. And he's looking for a little more attention, aren't you, big fella?
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Winnipeg's transit system is getting a bit greener and will soon add 16 zero-emission buses or ZEBs to its fleet. The Investing in Canada Infrastructure Program provided $280 million to rehaul Winnipeg's transit infrastructure and vehicles. 16 zero-emission buses have been purchased as part of the Transition Fleet Project. Different kinds of zero-emission buses will be tested on Winnipeg streets to see which ZEBs are most effective. Winnipeggers can expect to see their first ZEBs in mid-March. The company's second order of ZEBs is expected in early 26. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
For many, waiting along Winnipeg's roads, the sound of roaring bus engines is a common occurrence. We can expect to hear this when Winnipeg Transit's latest additions hit the streets this spring. Winnipeg has now welcomed its second zero-emission bus, or ZEB, to its fleet as it transitions from diesel vehicles. $280 million through the Investing in Canada Infrastructure Program is being used to rehaul transit's infrastructure and vehicles. Aaron Cook, project manager for the Transition to Zero-Emission Bus Program, explains.
Hydrogen infrastructure has been one of the challenges that's not really established in Manitoba right now. So that's one of the challenges that we're looking at these buses right now. We actually have to build our own hydrogen generation station here. So will be operational later this year. So we have a little bit of gaps in getting this in the road and into regular service until that station's operational. The power needed for these buses is huge. So we're working with Manitoba Hydro to scale up all of our infrastructure.
16 zero emission buses have been purchased as part of the Transition Fleet Project. Four 40-foot and four 60-foot fuel cell battery electric buses and four 40-foot and four 60-foot battery electric buses will be tested to see which ZEBs are most effective here in Winnipeg.
Yeah, so the hydrogen buses, you refuel with hydrogen, so it's about a 10-minute process for fueling, once our station's fully operational, that is. So then the bus is ready to go for about 20 to 24 hours straight. So it's still a little less than a diesel bus, but more than enough to do a full day operation. The battery electric buses, they have about 440 kilowatts of battery capacity on them, kilowatt hours. So those have to charge for 3 to 4 hours. So
the results of this testing will determine which technology Winnipeg Transit will prioritize in the long run. At first glance, the new buses may not appear drastically different. They maintain the familiar layout and accessibility features, including updated color-coded seating that aligns with the Accessibility for Manitobans Act. However, passengers will immediately notice the quiet ride and the smoother experience on the road. Cook says the new buses are just part of what's on the horizon for transit customers, with Winnipeg undergoing a significant route overhaul this June.
We're undergoing two of the biggest changes. So the network is really the biggest change that people will see on the street, and transition to zero emission is the biggest internal change that we're undergoing. It's really touching everything that we do here. Every department is impacted by this, and people are going to see this, but what you're going to see is better service. We're really focusing on getting reliable service. We're getting better quality service. We're looking at innovation. We're looking at ways to improve the way that people move around the city.
Winnipeg Transit aims for 30% electrification by 2030 and a fully zero-emission fleet by 2045 or sooner. Winnipeggers can expect to see the first ZEBs in mid-March, with Transit's second order of 24 ZEBs anticipated for early 2026. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
So you might remember that in October of 2024, BC's Lower Mainland experienced an atmospheric river, a long narrow section in the atmosphere that transports water vapor outside of the tropics. The severity of the weather event resulted in significant precipitation levels, infrastructure damage from flooding, and according to findings from the West Vancouver's Dreamkeeper Society, historically high counts of local salmon population. The organization presented findings from their yearly salmon count at the West Vancouver City Council, where they stated that the atmospheric event in October had actually proven to be a benefit for local salmon populations. Journalist Danny Nesvadirani in Burnaby, BC, met with Leslie Pomeroy at Brothers Creek in West Vancouver. That's where the high salmon counts were first observed. Pomeroy is a lead volunteer for the West Vancouver Streamkeepers Society.
It was really interesting. So I don't know if you remember, but the atmospheric river happened on voting day. And I was out helping with a campaign, and I was with somebody who's actually an MP in West Vancouver, and she was getting all these texts of floods, massive floods. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was down 21st and 25th. There were just rivers. And then Marine Drive was underwater. A bunch of businesses were damaged. And I had a survey. My team was supposed to go out on the Sunday. And the girls were wondering if we should cancel. And I said, no, we're not canceling. This is an amazing opportunity to see the effects, the firsthand effects of climate change on our creeks. So I was basically preparing it to be a lesson in, the devastation of climate change. I sort of prefaced it with, we're not going to see any fish, but we can see what has happened to the creeks as a result of the really extraordinarily high water levels. And sure enough, we did see a lot of there was a bit of erosion, not a ton, but just, you know, the water had to find new channels down the creek and things like that. And we did several, we have five zones, and we got to here, this was our final zone, and we actually saw three chum in the creek. And the water was still running incredibly fast. I don't know how they stayed in the creek or if they somehow got back up the following day. But it was, we'd had quite a few fish prior to then. The fish numbers dropped dramatically after the atmospheric river, but within, you know, a week, they were way high. So I would say that the main benefit for salmon was just the high water levels. It makes it so much easier to move up the creek. And we've had, I mean, as you know, we've had several years of drought for Vancouver. Yeah, when the water levels are high, I mean, you can see over here where you've got lots of rock. If you don't have a lot of water, they simply can't move up the creek.
Pomeroy also spoke about the initial surprise that came from the salmon count due to the negative human effects of the atmospheric river.
Because we view the atmospheric river from a very human point of view, which is like, oh, there's so much water, it's going to be hard to get up the creek. But it, in fact, is a completely different experience for the salmon. I think we were also really surprised because the chum predictions were extremely low. Like, they thought we were going to have a very bad year for chum. And we ended up having a huge year. And within the first week we saw fish, second week we only saw three, but then the next week people just started reporting massive numbers of fish in the creeks. So yes, it was surprising. What was also surprising was that, human devastation aside, it proved to be a wonderful refresh for the creek. Because we've had so many years of relatively low water flow, so you don't get a lot of redistribution of gravel. Erosion is actually kind of good for the creeks because it gets gravel in to the creeks, and that's the ideal spawning material for the salmon. Yeah, and that was unanticipated by us, but of course, in retrospect, makes perfect sense.
Lastly, Leslie Pomeroy talked about what people should do if they want to become more involved with their local creeks and ecosystems.
What I love about the streams is they give you an insight to one aspect of the environment, but one that affects everything around it and is affected by everything around it. So, yeah, if we have healthy streams, it's likely to be reflective of a healthier environment, which I'm sure even if human beings don't care about salmon and don't care about streams, they probably care about, you know, the health of their own environment. Yeah, that's another thing. And West Vancouver Streamkeepers is a great organization. We have a website that I would encourage anybody who's interested in going and having a look at, but also look into streamkeeping organizations in your own neighborhoods. Always looking for volunteers. I'm pretty certain all of them are always looking for volunteers. And yeah, there's lots of opportunity to get out and get in the creeks and enjoy nature.
Once again, that was Leslie Pomeroy of the West Vancouver Streamkeepers Society. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
March is Agriculture Literacy Month in Canada, and in Ontario, local farmer Janet Harrop says it's never been more crucial to learn about agriculture and how to support local farmers. Harrop says that with tariff threats creating financial stress for farmers and kids, often being removed from farming, the time is now to zone in on buying local fruit and vegetables and learning more about farming. Harrop, who is the past president of the Wellington Federation of Agriculture and a dairy farmer herself, feels that Agscape, an organization providing free downloads and curriculum lessons to classrooms, does great work throughout the month. But efforts to focus on agriculture need to be year-round. More with Ryan Gillespie-Wilson.
Making agriculture a year-round focus in the classroom is a goal of one of Wellington County's most recognized figures in the field. March marks Canadian Agriculture Literacy Month, which past president of the Wellington Federation of Agriculture and local champion of agriculture, Janet Harrop, says comes at a very crucial time. There's been more conversation lately surrounding agriculture Wellington County-wide, says Harrop. She explains Agscape, an organization providing free downloads and curriculum lessons to classrooms, provides a distinct focus on agriculture during March for all K-12 students.
Food and where food comes from and the nutrition of food in the lower grades, reinforcing that in the higher grades, and also talking about robotics and engineering and genetics and different things that we see as a common practice on farms that would lead to career choices and career decisions by kids.
Harrop explains understanding supply chains and how they can be disrupted is important work. She went on to further reiterate why this understanding is even more paramount now than it once was.
In Wellington County, we're starting to see a lot more conversation about agriculture. We are seeing people going into classrooms. Kids used to have, they were either involved in a farm or, you know, their parents or their grandparents. Many are removed generationally from contact with agriculture now. Understanding agriculture and all the facets of agriculture are so important.
Tariff threats further increase the need for a month like this and the year-round effort, Harrop says, to zone in on agriculture.
Having those discussions from a nutritional perspective, but also supporting our local businesses, because we are seeing definitely with the tariff threat, some industries that do export a fair bit that are looking at some pretty significant financial issues. So being able to support those commodities locally and look for those products, it's more important now than ever.
Canada is fortunate to have some of the highest food safety standards, Harrop explains. She says WFA's involvement in a recent all-parties provincial candidates debate reiterates how upper-level government is connected to local farming.
Decisions are made in Toronto and Ottawa that directly impact us, whether it's around cost-share support programs, border control. Having the ear of the politicians and reiterating the importance of agriculture in this community from an economic perspective and a local perspective is vastly important.
Educating all on what they can do to support local farmers has great magnitude, Harrop says. As the country puts agriculture on the forefront this month, she is encouraging Wellington County residents to take stock of one of the region's largest economic drivers. This is Riley Gillespie Wilson reporting from the Local Journalism Initiative.
That's it for us. A big thank you to our journalists, Jules Bigiel, Elizabeth Oakley, Ryan Funk, Danny Nesvadarani, and Riley Gillespie Wilson. Our national editors are Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.